Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Folks, welcome. Mike Colomeco here. Mike Colomeco's Food Talk, Heritage Radio Network, back again. Welcome to March in New York City. Another balmy March day. Yeah, it's beautiful. Yesterday I was biking around New York with nothing more than a t-shirt. Took my little jacket off. Didn't need a windbreaker. It was about 60 degrees at midday. Rained a little bit last night. Got up this morning to 30 mile an hour winds, 22 degrees. And I was like changing gears on my bicycle to go on a flat road because the winds are 30 miles an hour. It's bloody cold. So I don't know. Winter's not letting go this year, but enough of that. We got a good show today. A couple of updates. I had a couple of guests slated for today, and one of them, unfortunately, couldn't make it. Ben, who's one of the bakers with Jessamine up at Hot Bread Kitchen, which is an amazing story. We'll get them back here. They're up in Spanish Harlem. They do amazing work. They've got amazing products. But really, the story behind Hot Bread Kitchen is Jessamine's story in terms of what she's doing for immigrant women in New York City. But if you don't live in New York, you may not have known. I don't think it made national news. It was a huge explosion, 116th Street, yesterday in Spanish Harlem, that took down two buildings with a gas leak. Several people dead, many more missing. That was right across from Hot Bread, so they had to, obviously, like everybody else, shut down, evacuate, lost a day's production. So this was the first day they were back in line. So, of course, they're not going to be with me today. We'll have them back another time. Ben is a great personal story as to how he kind of came from a hard scrabble, really base, barely working class childhood out west to becoming the pastry chef, head baker at Per Se, working with Thomas Keller for years on his bread programs before he ended up at Hot Bread. And Jessamine is a great story in and of herself, but I'll save that for another day when we have them back live. The guest we do have live today is a guy I've known for a long time, great New York chef, has been around the city for over two decades now, has had a restaurant, an eponymous restaurant on the Upper West Side that is a great restaurant, one of the best in that neighborhood for sure, and he just opened up recently down in Tribeca, and we'll have Bill Telepan on microphone in a couple of minutes. I just want to do a couple of shout-outs like we usually start out the beginning of the show with. Congratulations to the team at Contra. To Jeremiah Stone, to Fabian von Hauske. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I met them both. I've been to the restaurant. I've had a meal there maybe a month ago. It took me a while to get in, but I always try and give restaurants a little time to get their sea legs under them. And it's a couple of guys, man. I've been talking about this for a while. There's this sort of, I don't want to call it the reverse Brooklyn effect, but I can tell you I know of more than a half a dozen to a dozen projects that might have, should have, were going to happen in Brooklyn and ended up doing a U-turn crossing the Williamsburg Bridge and happening on my side of the East River. They just got reviewed, so the congratulations for the two-star review they got yesterday from Wells in the Times. But it's funny, there was a mention by Wells that this is exactly that kind of a place that in every other way looks as if it should be somewhere in Brooklyn. Chefs are really young, they're really stoked, really independent, really singular vision for the restaurant. It's a $55 five-course prefix menu. You do not have choices except, I believe, with the last course with the protein. Otherwise, it's a set menu. You don't like something, you just don't get that course. Having said that, when I was there, they were busy. Every time I walk by, they're busy. They're down in my neighborhood on Orchard. Wine list is great. Linda Milagros is in charge of that. The night we were there, she just poured some super wine pairings for us. So congratulations. Again, these two really young guys that are sort of adding weight to that Lower East Side dining scene that just keeps getting better. A little further west from there, I had another great meal the last couple of days at the Musket Room. which is a funny place. It's on Elizabeth Street, just south of Houston, just north of Public and Peasant and those places, in a block that's becoming neat. Estella is right around the corner on Houston. So this is literally around the corner from Estella. Jeremiah Stone is a, Musket Room. Matt Lambert is the chef, and Matt's from New Zealand, born and raised. He's a Kiwi, and it's actually kind of a New Zealand-themed restaurant. He brings in some fish from New Zealand, brings in some venison from New Zealand, some olive oil, huge wine list that skews about 80% from New Zealand, a lot of bio and organic. That's great. Food is killer. Name of the place is called The Musket Room. Really, really solid. He has not gotten a ton of press yet. Opened last June. I suspect that may change at some point soon. So there you go. Two new places that I've been to recently that I just absolutely love. Let's get Bill on. I'm going to have Bill come on the show today with us, stay for about, three quarters of the show, and then let him go because he's a busy man with two restaurants and one that's just opened. Bill, welcome, man.
Hey, man. How are you?
So have you been here before? You been at the Heritage?
Been in Heritage many times.
You
yes.
have been?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
I did the,
I can't get any new guests out here.
I'm sorry. I did the one with Dorothy Hamilton and Marion Anna Cutler. And,
okay.
And I've done it a few times. I've been on, Zach Palacio was one of the original ones here.
Zach?
Yeah.
Zach was on the microphone doing interviews?
Then girlfriend or now wife. And
Yeah. So they worked together.
They did a show that I was on and early on and stuff. So, yeah, I've been here. I've only had the pizza once since in the times I've come. I mean, I've come out for the pizza before, but
it's good.
Yeah, it's very good.
It's good, and the food's really good too.
The food's really good here.
You just have to get. I mean,
I'd love to check out Blanca too one of these days.
Yeah, that's like that's the serious. Yeah. Like that's where he's where he's firing on all cylinders.
And it's not it's not hard. It's not a hard get to from Upper West Side or Tribeca.
So. No, people.
You know, for me, it's an L.
Yeah, you got to get to 14th, and you just get to 14th anywhere.
Exactly.
The L you can pick up from First Avenue to the Chelsea Market,
right, exactly.
All the way across 14th Street. So there's six or seven stops. Yep. Every single line crosses the L at some point.
Yeah.
Most every. I shouldn't say that, but
damn near
everyone.
Yeah, sure.
I know. A lot of times, depending on where I am, I'll either take the subway and transfer, or now that I've moved down to the Lower East Side to Grand Street, just to save time, because for me it's kind of a hassle. I've got to take the F, but the F takes me west and north. It takes me the wrong direction for half the trip, and I'll pick up the L at 6th Avenue, whereas I can just bicycle up to 14th and 1st, which takes 10 minutes.
On a day like today, though, you don't want
to bicycle. I did.
That's nuts.
I just did.
I didn't even want to come.
It sucked. I can tell you what. I drove down my street. I went underneath the Williamsburg Bridge, made a left-hand turn, so I'm biking due west. I literally said to my mate when I came in, I bike with gears. I'm not one of these punks. Excuse me. I'm not one of these kids that's driving around on a fixed gear bike. Sorry. I like brakes and gears. That's kind of how I grew up. And I just remember like on a flat road shifting down like six gears to fight the wind. It was nuts. It was like climbing a hill.
It's been a tough winter. It's been a tough winter for most of America. But yeah.
Yeah, it could be. I was thinking. Shut up. Don't whine. You and I have been in New York a long time. I remember people sledding, skiing down Fifth Avenue. I remember blizzards when everything got shut down.
But the Hudson would be frozen. Never this cold. Consistently.
And this long and merciless.
Exactly. We're in the mid-March now.
And next week ain't looking good.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I thought
we were done.
No, we're not. It's going to warm up on Saturday, and there's a chance of flurries and junk Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday again. It's cold. It ain't done yet, man.
My birthday's in April, so that's sort of like this. I mean, it has snowed around my birthday, but for me, it's just that's the sign that says to me, like, it's ready. It's gone, and we're going to move forward.
I hope ocean's been cold down where I am on the beach, which is never a good sign. I mean, colder than it should be, and that mitigates everything.
Well, then maybe we won't have a hot summer.
No, the opposite. So I check that stuff, too.
I think with the global,
they check ocean temperatures for that El Nino phenomenon.
El Nino.
75% of the people that forecast say it's going to be one of the hottest summers on record. I know we're going to get hosed.
I keep telling everybody, I go, you know what? It's probably going to hit 110 this summer.
Yeah, right.
And we've never, I don't think we've had that ever.
Yeah, well,
anyway,
I'll be in Phoenix weather. I'll be in Cape May.
With the humidity.
With the humidity.
I'll be in a kitchen in New York City.
I know. Shut up, Mike. Shut up, Mike. He's got a real job. Happy birthday coming up.
Thank you.
42, 43.
Oh, thank you. Thank you again for that.
Big boy. A youthful 48. Well, 48's the new 27 or something.
I feel great.
So tell me. I mean, I know you've been on the show before, so I guess it's going to get redundant, but I can never tell how our listenership.
Well, I've talked about many things, so okay. I'm somewhat of a renaissance man, Michael.
A renaissance man? I know. I agree. I had a list of things. I'm like, okay, what am I going to talk to Bill about?
I've been on various topics. You know, I've talked about the restaurant Telepan when I just had Telepan. I've talked about wellness in the schools, the program I do in the public schools.
Check those two boxes. We're going to talk about that again today.
You know, but now
we're going to talk about Telepan Local.
We have Telepan Local.
Yes.
So, which is an interesting a new thing for me. So
before we get there, and I don't know if you talked about this, but I always love backstory because I have chefs. Last week, Shane McBride. Every week, there's a chef that comes out here that I torture. We have fun. We talk about it. And kind of like the PBS show. I just love I'm going to assume
which was great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
That was
thanks.
Awesome.
I forgot.
That was,
but that's right.
That was great.
I shot that with my massive mop of gray hair before I cut that off.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a fun shoot. That was fun. Got a lot of emails. Where is that place? Who was that guy? Just go. Don't worry about it. So you got started when, how old, and where?
Well, I graduated CIA when I was around 21 years old, and I started at Gotham Bar and Grill and worked there.
But you cooked before that, no?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I cooked as a kid.
I mean, I was 15 working at a deli and then went and played baseball and then took a dishwashing job in a local Italian restaurant when I was like 16 and 16. And then I worked there for about a year, ended up maybe a little longer working full time with them until they closed it to move to a new location. Then I found a couple little odd jobs and a ground round, which was torture. I worked at a gas station. And then I found another place called Garfunkel's in my town, which was run by a chef. You know, it was like a glorified Fridays, but it was run by a chef who graduated from the CIA. Who then became the general manager and brought in another CIA grad, and then decided at that point I was going to go to college and quit cooking and was going for engineering. This is just a few months, so I quit around the time I graduated and worked at UPS loading washing trucks, not even loading, which was great because loading trucks sucked. And I used to watch all the guys anyway. So and then I missed it. And I would stop by the restaurant. I just was like, college is going fine, but I just was like, you know, I really missed. And I would stop by the restaurant because on my way home from, I was going to school nearby my house and see everybody and then talk to them and told them I missed it. And they said, well, you should go to the Culinary Institute of America. And we've been there. We know some people up there. We'll take you on a tour and sort of help you get in when you want to get in. So they did that and decided to quit college and the job at UPS and then went back to work with them for a year and learned a lot of stuff that was, you know, not like, you know, to make me the chef I am today, but
helpful
to sort of,
before you went to school.
Exactly. Very
That's
helpful
huge.
Before
yeah.
I went to school because, you know, you go into the meat fabrication class and I was the only one who knew how to break down a veal leg. And right. you go into, you know, there was a lot of questions I knew already. And then when we actually got into the kitchens, it really helped me. They gave me the tools to learn more than I would have if I went in there without doing this.
Started cooking at 13, knucklehead, you know, high IQ, shitty grade. I didn't give a shit about school. It was drugs and girls.
Right.
Went to college for 3 minutes, kicked shit around, played guitar. But I cooked all those years, high school, college, junior high, all those years. So when I went to CIA, I probably had 10 years, and I was 24. And I remember, I don't recommend people going to cooking school. When I'm asked that, I tell people, you know, I think better work in the trade first, see if you like it before you shell out 60 grand to find out you don't. But to your point, by the time I got to the CIA, I sucked every drop of juice out of that place. I was studying in the library. If I thought the PM's class was better than the AM class, I'd take both.
Right.
I mean, and then I knew, like you were saying,
you were a little more ambitious. I was enjoying the 7-hour classes and going out partying afterwards.
You were younger than me, man. This was my last chance. My family was basically like, don't come home. You know, goodbye. The door closes one way, son. No, this was when I had to make it stick. And I really loved that place. I got a ton out of it.
Yeah. No, it was great for me because, you know, I coming from New Jersey and not really knowing, like, not really knowing what was going on outside of it so much. Right. And then meeting, you know, the people, like the chefs up there and other cooks. And then, you know, when I was about to graduate, I befriended one of the chefs up there who was just, you know, liked me a lot. And then and sent me to go see Charlie Palmer, who was then at the River Cafe.
What chef?
His name was Chef Dannon.
Oh, Dannon was huge. He was in the E-Room, dude.
Yeah,
he was a Belgian guy.
He was a he was crazy.
He would test
the fryer with his finger.
Right.
And then take a student's hand and test it with the finger.
Once he saw a student taking a roast out of a pan with a fork, with a carving fork.
Oh, that was it.
He proceeded to pull the carving fork out, stand in the guy's face and scream at him.
Yeah.
And when the kid asked why, he stabbed him in the hand with a strap.
Yeah, no, believable stories because I've seen him firsthand.
He stabbed him in the hand with the fork and said, because it makes it bleed.
Right.
He was okay.
Really? I mean, that's kind of nuts in a way, but in a way you get he was the kind who was passionate and really believed it and was probably the only chef I kind of like connected with, even though he was crazy. But he sort of helped push me in a direction that I wouldn't have known where to go. So I went to the River Cafe, but
which was huge.
He didn't have a job for me. So I just sort of took this job at the Seaport where I was making good money. I knew it wasn't what the River Cafe was, having spent the day there. And then I got a call from Alfred Portali, who then said, I got your resume from Charlie Palmer. I need a cook. Can you come see me? And I was off that night and drove in. I was living in with my parents in New Jersey at the time, and I drove in to see him. And he gave me and I just was like, I'm taking this job because Charlie Palmer told me, you know, sent this thing. And I didn't know who he was. And he asked me, he goes, have you heard of the restaurant? I said, yeah. Right. So I went back home.
This is before Google and all this shit.
Yeah, no, totally. Right. So I had like a stack of gourmet magazines and I flipped through them to see if I could find a review of Gotham. And I found one and I read about it. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And
3 stars since Alfred's been there.
Yeah, it was, I mean, and then, you know, you go to work in this kitchen, you know, coming from where I came from. And all of a sudden you're in one of the hottest, if not the hottest at the time. This is 87. So Gotham was 3 years old.
Huge.
And it was busy and celebrities and food critics and fast-paced and beautiful food and technique, and it was just insane. And the first month, I was like, God, my back. I'd go home, and my back would be so sore, and I had to get in shape for it. And so, but it was great because the cooks were great, the energy was great. I loved it. I just friggin' loved it. And I didn't care how much I sucked in the beginning. I was determined to do really well though, because everybody was. There was this sort of unspoken competitiveness that was just really great, and so all the cooks were great, you know, and then
the idea that, to your point, because we all remember back in the day when we were line cooks,
right,
and we had no idea. We know we wanted to be good. We were aiming high. We thought we might have been good, but we weren't. I mean, you look back now with it was wonderful, but we could have fucked up and been out of a job the next day on any given day. You just didn't know.
Yeah, I mean,
but the idea that you're working on a line and the guy next to you, the poissonnier, the entremetier, the saucier, the sous chef, that it's almost like the sports team where everyone's raising everybody's game. You're not going to serve a mistake. You're watching. You make sure your mise en place is done.
You don't want to be the one who gets called out.
Yeah,
you know,
and I think, what's this in the past? Who made this? What's this piece of shit?
Right, and that was you know that, and that would just suck out at the time out of everybody. It just would make it really bad, and so. I got to, fortunately, I stayed there almost 3 years. And worked
your way up to sous chef.
And yeah, I worked my way up to when I left. So I basically plowed through all the stations in that time, learned everything I could out of that place, and then went off. And it was a time when France was the place to go. Mm. Alfred worked in France. Charlie Palmer worked in France.
Yep.
Every major New York City, any major American chef went to go work in France.
You had to do a stage.
I had friends who worked at Gotham who went to go work in France. And so I was just like, well, maybe I should go to France because it just seems like the right thing to do. And I did. And I went
And it was for a lot of reasons, especially back then.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot for – and in the way that the most I got out of – I went to go work with Alain Chappelle, who was a three-star Michelin chef at the time.
Yeah.
And was really lucky to be in this small town in France. And I'll tell you the most I got out of it. It wasn't the technique obvious – I mean – except for the obvious shit, you know, like the technique was great. Yeah. the product was great, and that's kind of what really flipped me. It's just the culture of food there is just was totally different than what you saw in America. And probably still, you're starting to see a good movement now in America, but at that time, it was. I met a family out there. They would break for 2 hours. They would have this glorious meal, and it was serious. It was like you hear these stories, but it's true. I mean, we had this 2-hour lunch, and the grandmother made this fabulous dinner, and it was brilliant. And their rabbits were coming from there, and they lived in a suburb, so they had rabbits and they had chickens, and we were eating the shit. And she made really marvelous meals, and it was so nice. And so, but it was there that the product. I started to understand the importance of the product from him and the people he worked with, from the all the stuff coming through the back door.
All the stuff he would
bring.
A mushroom guy, a rabbit guy, the cheese guy, the affinage guy, the brilliant guys with the stuff. Pheasant, the guy with the hair, the butcher.
It was really great, and it was strawberries that did it for me.
Frais de Bois or strawberries?
No, strawberries. I mean, we saw Frais de Bois there, but a little later, but it was just... I was like, wow, this is
food.
That really turned it and made, like, it was the light bulb that went off in my head. And then coming back after 6 months, and then I worked with at Le Bernardin when Gilbert Lacoze, again, it was...
Eberhard was the chef?
Eberhard was
Dominic
the chef.
Dominic Cerrone. What a great kitchen.
And product, again, it was... Yeah. But it was different. It was seafood, and it was pristine, sort of simple. I mean, it was amazing how when you look back... on what people do the food now to see what they were serving. It was simple and elegant, and we threw a lot of old fish away for sure. And it wasn't and it was just great. And so then from there did a year and worked with Daniel Ballou when he was at Le Cirque, took a saucier job there, and then stayed with him for 6 months, and I remember having to give notice, and I said, I'm leaving. And he's like, what? You've only been here for 6 months. And I said, yeah, but I'm taking – Alfred offered me the executive sous chef job at Gotham, and I really want to take it. And he said, all right, you can go. But if this was just another cook's job, I'd kick your ass right now.
Well, Danielle, too. He's been one of the great mentors. Now,
and he's just a great – I mean, I've only worked with him for 6 years and six months, and we're like – he's – so generous with his time, and always has been. So, and
that's just the man
day.
In him. That's just the man in him.
And
the generosity of spirit, generosity of heart. Will share knowledge with everybody. And, remembers things.
And
he's
great. And I think, you can't discount the thing. What he's great at is his sort of want to have the customer have a great time, and it's not about him. And I think, working at Le Cirque with Sirio in there, and that's Sirio's thing, too. So to have Danielle, to have worked for a guy like Sirio, he really took that concept of the customer, because Sirio was the front man.
Sirio was the ultimate.
He was the end of the front man, and Danielle was the beginning of the chef.
Sirio was the patron. Sirio was his restaurant, but he was a maitre d'. He was the that restaurant. I mean, you can't overemphasize. I know Sirio is on his on his last legs these days.
Well, he's 81.
He's 81, but he's still there. I mean, but people don't really in the 80s and early 90s. That was one of the great restaurants in the city, and
it was the greatest.
It was the hardest ticket to get a table to.
I mean,
every any night you had kings and queens and princes, heads of state.
It was insane.
The tycoons of industry. It was nuts.
It was insane, the stuff that you did there. I mean, it was the best restaurant at the time, and I was privileged to work there. I mean, it was just a great opportunity, and I always reflect on how lucky I was to be there at that time, and Danielle was at his top because he was thinking about doing Danielle at the time because he had mentioned to me, he was hoping, I would stay on because he was thinking about taking me to go help him open the new place, which would have been unbelievable.
Your opening team.
But
Gotham was huge, and this is a bump up.
Well,
so now
Gotham was great. It was a very important position. I'd just gotten married, and I was young. I was 25 at the time, and I know what it meant, and the thing was, it was now I was running a restaurant. I wasn't just cooking anymore. I was running a restaurant. I did all the purchasing. I was responsible for food costs. I helped hire people. I fired people. I helped create dishes. It was just 4 years of training that you don't get often. You know what I mean? And I don't even think my sous chefs get this kind of but there was a lot of, you know, responsibility, and what we got reviewed.
Did they just have 20th, 30th anniversary? Because it was just, I missed it. I was out of town.
Anniversary is coming up now.
Coming up. Yeah, I'm out of town. I can't make it.
It's the 28th. And so, I mean, 30 years.
Huge. And 3 stars under Alfred's helm. Credit due.
All the time.
Every review. And he wasn't the opening. That restaurant was opened by Jerome with, I'm not going to mention her name, but it was a New York consultant at the time who wasn't exactly a chef. She was like a culinary consultant. It was a different era. And I remember they had black plates, and it was quasi-Mediterranean Moroccan.
We used those black plates for staff meal. I mean,
you still have, and well, the again, restaurant it was, sucked. So Alfred came into a sinking ship.
It was right that time when the chef became more important than the owner, you know?
Well,
Andre Saltner was...
The owner and the chef.
Was, you know, a chef owner, but...
And Jean-Jacques Rechou and a couple other guys.
But they were French. But this was when the Americans... Yep. I mean, Danielle's French also, but, you know, but that was... But what Danielle did was really changed, sort of became... He became, I think, one of the first celebrities. I might be wrong. I'm missing probably some people. But it's just, you know, but the Gotham job was just invaluable into how I was able to open any restaurant since, you know, and how to run it and how to organize it and how to create food that was still consistently delicious, looked great, and do a lot of covers, you know, because
it's funny in talking about the paradigm between working. I got to work with Alan Sandrin's in Paris at Arcistrat, which is a little tiny restaurant, left bank, 3-star Michelin, beautiful kitchen. And I remember, like, what you were saying, I'm just nodding my head, the ingredients were unbelievable, the technique was unbelievable, but the coming back to New York City, there was this huge disconnect. We had 18 to 19 people in the kitchen, maybe 20 in the kitchen.
At Sandrin's.
Yeah. And we did 40 to 50 covers. There was almost one cook per customer. Right. And the pace was very different. We weren't turning tables.
Right.
At Sandrin's for night, for dinner, you pretty much did one seating.
Right.
I mean, people came in at 7:30, 8, and they stayed till 11.
Right.
And then you get back to New York with this bon bagage, this head full of ideas for the, and then you realize, Whoa. The ingredients back then weren't as good. They are now. Right. I'd say now they're as good or better than...
I agree.
It's insane how we've moved in 25 years. But the ingredients weren't the same. You're kind of dealing with Baldur and bullshit and stuff off of trucks, and you just had to take it. It was what it was. But the biggest difference was, fucking New York, man, you turn the dining room 3 times at night.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to pay those rents in New York City?
Yeah.
Forget the one cover shit.
Yeah, the whole business plan is very different.
Right. So the idea, and I think where Gotham distinguished itself and always has, as good restaurants have, is that ability to have accurate cooking, great tasting plates, consistency across the board, and to be able to deal with crushing volume.
Right.
And not collapse under the weight of
it. Yeah, no, anywhere I went after was, you know, easy.
My guest is Bill Telepan. He's got a couple of restaurants in New York City, one on the Upper West Side that's been there 8 years.
Yeah.
8 years. Called Telepan, eponymous restaurant. It's wonderful. 67th?
9th.
69th, sorry. 67th Café des Artistes block. 69th, right off Central Park West, between Central Park West and Columbus, south side of the block. Great, great. You just did a renovation. I haven't been in to see it yet, but food spot on. Service is spot on. Beverage service is great. And we're going to talk in a couple of minutes about your new venture downtown in Tribeca.
Yes.
Telepan Local. We're going to take a quick spot. This is radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. I'm Mike Colomeco, the host of Mike Colomeco's Food Talk here out in Bushwick, the epicenter of the Brooklyn Church of Hipness, of which, sorry, I leave. I come. They allow me in, and then I leave.
I'm feeling hip right now.
You are?
Yeah. Got my vest on.
You have a vest on. Yeah. We got to work on the beard or something.
I just shaved this morning. Sorry.
Big long honking one or no, just from stubble. Last night. Okay, a stubble. Anyway, we'll take a quick spot. If you like these shows, this show and others like it, you know, go to heritageradionetwork.org and contribute. This is pretty much commercial free stuff. We don't shill for people. Everybody's got a different show, lots of different points of view. I want to let Bill leave in about 15 minutes because he's got to get back to run 2 restaurants tonight. And I want to talk about stuff that we get to talk about on this station that you're not going to hear much about on regular broadcast because it's point of view stuff, it's opinions. and we aren't exactly going to get money from Tyson Foods after you hear what I have to say in a few. But anyway, we'll take a quick spot, and we'll be back with Bill Telepan talking about what he's up to these days. Stay tuned for more of Michael Michael's Food Talk coming up right after this.
Today's music is by Obesity on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey folks, Mike Alameco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano. Michael Alameco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters. And I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about. But a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet. It pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. I'm Mike Alameco. You're listening to Mike Alameco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. My guest And you can't really tune in early to this show or tune in late, can you? I don't know how internet radio works. I did old radio for years when people would spin the dials and latch on to things and say, what am I listening to? So we used to have to ID ourselves all the time. That was old school radio. Hey, this is Michael Lemeco. You're listening to WOR's Food Talk. We'll be back in a moment after we sell you some stuff. But anyway, Bill Telepan's my guest. Let's talk about Telepan first a bit, because it's, I mean, that's a place where you spread your wings, establish.
Yeah.
I mean, you already had an established name, but that was a, kind of a roll of the dice. That's where you were stepping out. Your name's on the front door. It's your restaurant. From day one, and you were kind of an early guy in this. You were buying locally. You're hitting the farmer's market. You tell me the story about Telepan, what you had in mind, and how you, what you've been consistently doing over the last 8 years.
Well, you know, I had been at the previous jobs I had. I mean, I started buying a lot from the Green Market when I was sous chef at Gotham. So back in 91, 92. Got to know all the farmers and knew that when I was going to be a chef, this is what I wanted to do. So 96, I opened Ansonia, and did that like hardcore. I don't know. I mean, David Boulay was doing it. Danielle was doing it. John George was doing it. Alfred was doing it. So like when people say I'm a pioneer, I'm like, maybe I was the first one to say like, I'm buying strictly seasonal, even though I did a lot with these guys. I mean, you know, America at the time in restaurants was, it was a lot of color. So it was, and getting the best product from around the world. And, you know, I just remember a lot of red and yellow peppers a lot. And so,
and those baby vegetables that were ubiquitous everywhere.
Yeah, but you know, and people would say, oh, baby vegetables, but you know, some baby vegetables obviously are just beautiful when they're grown properly. And so I really wanted to sort of follow that seasonal mantra, buy locally from these people who I built relationships over the years. And then I took over Judson Grill. It was this huge place, got 3 stars, but it was sort of like, you look at the space and it was in Midtown, and it had to be, yeah. you had to feed a certain clientele that was you huge. Had to really be accessible.
It looked like a yacht. I remember working over the first, it was, there was a mezzanine, there was 2 floors, there was a bar that was the size of a football field.
220 seats,
and you were in the theater district,
yeah.
Which means every single night, Tuesday through Sunday, you could pretty much expect 220 people to walk in the door between 5:30 and 6, and have to be out the door in 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, and so triage. So I was able to create a menu that sort of, you know, kept to what I wanted it to be accessible to the theater goers and the people who worked in the area, and then make it into a destination. And was there for 7 years, and so Telepan was sort of a product of its location, where you know, we wanted to be a sort of fine dining restaurant that was accessible to the neighborhood, because you know, you get your crowd of people who come in when you first open, and knowing 3 years ahead that, you know, I would be feeding the neighborhood and Lincoln Center goers, you know. And there's a lot of good hotels, so we could have some people from out of town across the park in the east side and also on the upper west. And so that's what I wanted. There's a restaurant called Cibreo in Florence, Italy, where it's, you know, the great food, great wine list, great staff, knowledgeable, fun. You walk in there, you're excited to be there, and you leave happier than you came in. Or if you're miserable when you go in, you come out happy. And so that was it. We wanted it to be a restaurant where people walked into and left happier than they were. And so it wasn't about like my ego or you know, we had the best kitchen, or we just wanted to have like a great restaurant. And we made it a point in the early beginnings to really work the neighborhood. So we kept tables open early on, got to know people, developed those relationships with the front of the house, and cooked what I wanted to cook. But in a way that I like to eat. And
no,
so,
your food, I almost feel like boring down, and asking you to like describe a dish on the menu now, because when we filmed, before we filmed that PBS piece last spring, I went in for dinner and just was, God damn it, this food is so good. It's just so chef driven. It's so solid. It looks simple. It's not that simple. There's a lot more going on the plate than you think in terms of technique, and ingredients are front and center. And then when we filmed, you did some demos. I mean, pick a dish on the menu and just walk me through it, because you really, I think, to get a sense of what you're doing, the way you handle things. I mean, your homemade pasta with mushroom, this everything is just so, it's like you think it's done, and then you're like, and then we do this, and we do that, and you're going like, oh yeah, that would make it
well,
that much better.
Well, a dish that's been on the menu since day one, that's very
smoked trout?
Simple. I was going to talk about the lobster.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about the smoked trout.
Let's talk about the smoked trout, because it's ridiculous. That's been there since day one, too.
That's been on since Judson, and that was one where people just were like, you know, this is great. And I mean, remember, like, Marcus Samuelson said to me one time when he ate at Judson, he says, you're so lucky to have this dish, because it's so great to have one dish that is so good. And so, you know, when he said something like that to me, it's just sort of – and I have customers who – I've been feeding basically since Ansonia and Judson for sure, and people come up to me. I have to come in for the smoked trout once in a while.
It's
a blini that has some form of it's a pancake recipe basically, and to that pancake recipe we add, depending on, three times a year, we'll just say I'll add potato to it, and the potato just add mixed with the egg and there's a little sour cream in it. And the little milk just sort of gives it this sort of silky texture. Yeah. So you have this pancake that's more like still fluffy, but still has some
body to it, some weight. Yep.
And then on top of that, so that comes out hot, and then you have this cold element, which is the smoked trout, and the smoked trout is not your typical smoked trout.
Right.
It's kind of like
it's not coming
trout,
in one of those
yeah,
big
you
bins.
You go to Zabar's and you ask for smoked trout, and it's dry and
it's
tasty, but
yeah.
But it's cured and it's dried. Where this is sort of, I want to say, rare to medium rare, and it's hot smoked very quickly for 40 minutes. So there's a faint smoke. So
you're
it's
buying
not
trout from upstate New York,
and the trout comes from upstate.
So you're getting local trout. You're smoking it,
right? And it's a quick 40. We're now doing it at the new restaurant where we turn the smoker on to 115 degrees for 25 minutes and turn it off and let it sit there for another 20 minutes.
So it cold smokes.
And we take
that.
It out.
Right.
And then it's still moist.
It's like almost medium rare.
More to medium rare.
Yeah, it's moist and unctuous.
And so you we just mix that with a simple dressing, a lemon dressing, and then put it on top of a sour cream that is seasoned. Like right now, it's a buckwheat blini, buckwheat and potato blini. So there's a little buckwheat flour in there. It's on top of a black radish sour cream, which has a little lemon juice, a little shallot in it, and then the smoked trout, and that's it. So
and it's, but that's it. And then you put your fork in and you put it in your mouth.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's
so you get this hot,
heaven.
Cold,
hot, cold,
soft, sexy, luscious.
And the protein
I love it.
And the trout is still great. Most smoked trout is dead meat.
Yeah. No. It's
like
it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's a great
like
place.
Really,
for it.
Just really smooth and it's luscious. And I think it's one of those things that there's acid. There's this sort of, like I said, the smoothness to the pancake. This heat. This cold. All sort of going together, and it goes throughout the entire, you know,
and smoke.
Bite.
It's
right.
It's perfect.
And there's a little smoke.
It's not salt. It's perfect. It's great. Talk
umami.
About,
is that
umami.
The word?
That's the word. That's the word. I always mispronounce.
Finally,
it.
I have a dish with umami.
We've had it for 20 years, apparently. So talk about Telepan Local. So we're going downtown. I want to switch gears. I want to get you out the door in five
so
minutes.
So what that is that we decide. What it was is my GM said to me. He went to Barcelona, ate at all these great tapas restaurants, came back, pointed his finger at me, right. Said, "Your next restaurant's going to be an American tapas right. restaurant." Take all those great ingredients that you get, all those great techniques you do, and just put four or five of them together, and then, you know, or three to five of them together, and you got this simple, beautiful little plate of food. And so that's what we did. So I brought on this kid, Joel Javier, who's worked with me for 7 years.
I've seen him in your kitchen.
Yeah.
No,
Joel is great, and he brings a whole nother sort of element of sort of experiences and backgrounds and you know, growing up stuff that we bring into it, and we just sort of put together this menu that's vegetarian based. We play on the snacky realm of tapas, and we just take our ingredients that we get and the people we work with. So we're using this great, beautiful American grass-fed beef. We're using the smoked trout in some things. We're getting great fish in. The vegetables are from the great people we buy from. And we're just able to, you know, one of the things that's a huge success there is this very simple shaved sunchoke and mushroom salad. So it's just mushrooms that are sunchokes that are marinated in a simple mushroom vinaigrette that has some sherry vinegar, shaved raw shaved raw cremini mushrooms and a little thyme, and it just explodes. And it's just really, you know, so that's one that's been getting a lot of great feedback. We have a pig in a blanket that we've been sort of, we make our own with grass-fed beef. We do a grilled cheese that's a play on a pan called tomat. And then, you know, like, I don't do Asian food, but, you know, and I want it, and we love these, you know, the Korean grilled short ribs. And so we do a version of that with kimchi that is only made with, you know, American or ingredients that are available in America. So
tell me this again. I'm sorry.
So it's grilled short rib with that we marinate the ribs.
So in, like galbay, like if you were going to K-Town.
I guess so. So it's, and you know, it's just it's honey, vinegar, and jalapenos is the marinade, and then we cook them for a bit, and then grill them real quick.
Small
and make this
plates.
Kimchi with cabbage, red pepper flakes, a little pear, onion, and scallion.
Yeah, that's all you need. Then start it.
Yeah.
And the little fish.
And we don't
stuff,
do the fish stuff.
You don't do the fish stuff. Okay.
No.
Okay. I gotta come in, man.
Yeah.
I think you invited me a while back. Maybe I'll bring my son. He lives in the city now. It'll be kind of a fun.
Yeah.
We've been going out a lot lately. It's fun to hang out with a 24-year-old boy, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's a nice life for him. Baltazar one night, pastis the next, Rouge Tomate. Yeah, you know, seasonal this weekend. Give me the address of
329 Greenwich Street is Telepan Local, and 72 West 69th Street is Telepan.
So Greenwich Street down there. So what's
Duane.
The Duane. That's across the street. It's bloody windy.
Yeah,
I used to live 310 Greenwich, so you're just up the block. And I remember coming out of my apartment. It's the Mitchell-Lama buildings. I was in the southernmost Mitchell-Lama. It was my first apartment in New York City. I remember coming out of that apartment, making a left-hand turn north.
What do you call those things?
Mitchell-Lama. That's the old New York affordable housing.
Oh, yeah.
It was a housing. Oh, it's a law. So Mitchell-Lama were two guys, I guess, that came around in the 60s. They built a lot of housing for... You know, this was back when people gave a shit about affordable housing in New York City.
Yes.
Unfortunately, those days are long past us.
They're numbered, yes.
So. Yeah. Now, if you want affordable housing in New York City, people are, you know, powers to be are suggesting the outer parts of the Bronx, the parts of Queens where, the subway doesn't run anymore. But Mitchell-Lama was built with the premise of affordable housing for working class New Yorkers. I had an illegal sublet, and I wish I'd had the presence of mind to get on the list, because it seemed like I could have gotten on the list. When the day I left, they said, you want to get on the list, and it was like 6 years. And of course, when you're 24, 6 years sounds like the end of the earth, and I
right.
didn't. But they're great buildings. But got to come in. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
I'll begin to see you soon. Bill Telepan has been my guest. Telepan Local, downtown on Greenwich. Telepan Uptown on 69th Street, Steffsaw Central Park West. A real New York pro. And just into that microphone, tell me, Beef 101, where do you get your beef from?
The beef I get from American Grass-Fed Beef. They're based in southeastern Missouri.
Okay.
The best American grass-fed beef you could buy. I know all the New York producers are going to hate me.
No, that's not true. Because I'm going to talk, the next thing I'm going to talk about is Tyson beef and the industry as we know it in the meat industry, which is just crazy these days. But anyway.
Better school lunches.
Oh, dude, we never even got there.
Wellnessintheschools.org.
Yeah. Oh, see,
Michael.
Thank you, Bill. See, I had all these notes, and we just talked. We weren't even drinking. We just talked. All right, that's what happened. We're drinking water. That's one of the other things that Bill does that is huge. He volunteers a shit ton of time for not just New York City schools, but schools all around the country, Wellness in the Schools, to get kids to just to get school lunches that are healthy, that are balanced, that are cooked with fresh vegetables, where we're cognizant of the fat content and the salt. And he has been recognized. So wellnessintheschools.org, I can also tell you, I'm going to embarrass him, he's walking out the door, but he won a Slow Food Award last year for the work that he does with Wellness in the Schools. So another great cause. Anyway, as I segue from Bill's interview to what I was going to talk about before he got here, but he got here early. Thank you. There's two great pieces I read this week in the New York Times. That's usually what I read. That's where I go to for news anyways, the New York Times. The Sunday Times is great because it's just, it's great. It's a kind of investigative journalism we see less and less of these days. Print journalism has been tough. Tough place to make money anymore, but the Times really, I think, still is the gold standard for writing really long form pieces. Buy and read the Sunday Times, read the Times Daily Online. Of course, the Wednesday Times is the big food section thing. And in the Sunday Times, there was a really big piece
that I'll go into later about antibiotics in beef. And it kind of traced a history. And it's curious. I don't know if Americans know this. They should. But for some strange reason, putting small doses of antibiotics in animal feed results in faster growing animals. Nobody knows why. It's just a fact. It was kind of discovered by accident years ago by farmers. In the 1950s, the accidents became so apparent to everybody, including the pharmaceutical industry, that was really the beginning of big agri-farming, was the 1950s, when the use of antibiotics, they call it the prophylactic use, meaning we're giving small amounts in feed, maybe prevents them from getting sick, we're not sure, but we know this one thing for sure, that it gets them to slaughter weight way faster than it would if we didn't give them antibiotics. The 50s was really the golden era and the beginning of commodity factory farming in this country. And the piece was about that. There's some great statistics in it that I'll come to later. And then just today I was reading the Times, and William Christoph, I think is his name, had a piece about Tyson. Did you know that four-fifths of the antibiotics that are made and distributed in America go to farms? Yeah. So human consumption, your kid's sick, maybe you're sick, maybe your mom or dad is sick, go to the doctor, get a prescription. Sick people, that's 20% of the use. The other 80% of antibiotics goes day-to-day use in farm feed. It's crazy. But they do it for a couple of reasons, and probably the biggest one is it brings the animals to slaughter weight faster. All animals, chicken, pork, beef, doesn't matter. Works across the board. And actually, they've tested it, believe it or not, in humans, and the same thing happens in human beings. Another story for another day. But we're in this crazy moment now. If you listen to this station, and I guess you do because you're listening to me and I'm on it, we've got a lot of people with a lot of great points of view on farming, on politics, on the politics of farming and eating, on poverty. I try and kind of cover everything. I'm kind of like a polyglot show here. I don't have a particular show with a particular point of view. I don't just talk about wine or farming or meat or fish or restaurants. I try and bring in a variety of guests because that's the show that I've always done for radio. And I've got an hour to kill. But in any case, so this issue, the piece today was how the consolidation in this industry, and I've talked about this before. So Tyson, which is an Arkansas-based company that started in the chicken business, kind of like Frank Perdue did. He was another Arkansas guy. And they made a fortune kind of cornering the market in the poultry business. And then Tyson hires smart people. You know, you graduate from Harvard Business School or the Wharton School, and if you're smart and do wait, Tyson will offer you a job because they're big and they want to kind of take over the world. So they've been buying people and taking things over, and there's a relationship with Whole Foods I really don't want to talk about, but Tyson chickens are now being sold in Whole Foods, unbeknownst to a lot of people, but they are because it's a huge account. They saw the market share there. They went to Whole Foods years ago and said, tell me about your, quote, organic chickens. They came back to Whole Foods and said, we can do that, and we can do it cheaper than your guys can, and Whole Foods became a customer. Tyson also bought Iowa Beef Packer, also known as IBP, which is one of the giants in the beef industry. So now Tyson, which was this behemoth to begin with, buys a beef company like IBP, and now they're cornering the beef market. They're also selling that beef in Whole Foods, but again, another story for another day. How big is Tyson, one might ask? Okay. Tyson slaughters weekly 135,000 head of cattle. That's right, 135,000 head of cattle, average weight, I don't know, 1,500 pounds. They slaughter 391,000 hogs. These are weekly numbers. Pretty impressive. That's a lot of hogs. Chicken, you ready to fall off the chair? Drum roll, 41 million. Yeah. It's crazy. And they've kind of really figured out how to do this. And the weird disconnect, I think the point that I'm trying to make is a couple of things. First of all, I know we're never going to get back to the 1920s when chickens, when all the chickens were being eaten in America were running around pecking on the ground, being happy birds. It's got to be some kind of middle ground. In 1930 money, okay, adjusted for inflation, adjusted for cost of living, etc. In 1930, Chicken cost $6.48 a pound. Chickens were a luxury. Americans didn't really eat them. Beef was cheaper. In 1930, $6.48 a pound for chicken. Today, that same price is $1.57. So in the span of 80 years, the availability to bring the cost of chicken from $6.50 a pound to $1.50 can be explained by factory farming. Who pays the price? Well, the environment pays the price. I don't know if you've ever lived. Most of us that live in the cities aren't familiar or don't live near chicken factory farms. There happen to be a few near me in Delaware. When I'm South Jersey, Cape May is right across the Delaware Bay from Delaware. Delaware is actually known for those. Of course, Arkansas is rife with them. The South is as well. They're just giant pens. It's horrible. I mean, these chickens, the kind of chicken that they've bred to be able to sold at these prices, A, they're being laced with antibiotics, B, they have no life, and the genetic disposition of this bird is designed to the breasts are so big that these birds can barely walk. They can barely breathe, actually. They just kind of get born, go from being little chicks to slaughter weight as fast as you can get them, live miserable, horrible, stinky lives inside of pens. Their health output is terrible. Anyway, it's gross. And that's the Tyson food story. The industrial farming world kind of makes tycoons rich, makes stockholders rich. I think Tyson's stock is up something like, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, I think it's quadrupled since 2009. So you got a few rich people making a ton of money off Tyson. You have really cheap factory chicken coming into the supermarkets. But at the same time that Tyson's gotten rich and the shareholders have gotten rich, you also have in the areas where Tyson works, the average worker in those counties, their income is less than average over the last 40 years. So it's funny. It's like they're sucking the life out of the country, if I can say that. And this is true with all commodity farming. So I'm not going to rail. I don't think we can, you know, all move out to the farms and have our own, you know, homegrown chicken coops and grow carrots and, you know, do the Green Acres thing. But there's got to be some middle ground. So that's my little riff today on commodity farming and all that stuff. It was great to have Bill Telepan on the show today. Lots of fun. And again, sorry we couldn't have Ben and Jessamine out from Hot Bread. They'll be here. When I'm back next week, we've got a couple of guests. I don't have my book in front of me. I'll tell you who it is later. Or you can look on the website. Or just wait. You'll find out. We always have good guests. And I know we have a good book, two guest book next week. And we're going to talk about wine a bit, because I had a big spiel I was going to do on wine today. New York Times, Eric Asimov. I know, enough with the Times, but it is a great paper, and the writers are great. Asimov had a great thing today. They're starting like a wine club or something like that. I don't have all the details, but I'm not going to shill for the Times. But he wrote a great piece about wine and drinking wine and tasting wine. And as you know, we've got a great show here. Joey Campanale has it. It's all about wine. Joey's one of these super young Psalms, one of these guys that gets me so excited because I don't even know if he's 30 yet, and he knows a shit ton about wine, and there's a lot of kids like him. So there's a whole lot of interest in wine. I'm fascinated about it. I talk about it a lot in this show. But Asimov's doing this thing about, you know, wine tasting. He's starting with Bordeaux, which I think is a great place to start. One of the points he mentioned today, before I sign off, is the difference between drinking wine and tasting wines. So, I mean, drinking wine's easy. We all do that, and there's a great natural pleasure to it. I've also said that in addition to drinking wine, if you just learn a little bit, if you take notes and concentrate and, you know, have a good stores near you and explore, the more you learn about wine, the more you know about wine, the broader your base of experience gets. There's an absolute correlation in the greater pleasure you'll take from it. So wine under close examination, I think, really yields great, great, deeper pleasure because you just get to know so much more intimately what you're talking about. And I don't mean we have to get geeky. Again, this is the drinking wine versus tasting wine thing. You know, tasting wines is what sommeliers do, what professionals do, because they have to sit down and taste 30 or 40 bottles at a seating, ascertain immediately the mineral notes, the fruit notes, the tannic notes. What's it going to pair with? How's it going to age? How can I sell this wine? They're not drinking wine. They're spitting it out. That's how it is. You know, swirl around, spit, swirl, spit. That's tasting wine. It's a lot more technical. Granted, you can learn a lot about wine by doing that, but for 99% of us, we're drinking wines. Whole different experience, because wines change from the time you open the bottle to the middle of the bottle to the end, change with the food that you're having with it. That's the kind of arc that I want to sort of concentrate on. So we'll talk about that, Asimov's piece, about wine a little bit more. So we'll be back next week. Take care, and I hope spring comes soon, because I, for one, am sick of this winter. I'm going to take the subway back to 14th Street, get on my bicycle, and freeze my ass off all the way home. But this time the wind will be at my back because it's blowing out of the northwest, and I'm going to head south. So there, that'll be the only good news. Mike Kalameko's Food Talk's name of the show. Heritage Radio Network is what you're listening to. If you like these shows, log on heritageradionetwork.org and send him a couple of bucks. Tons of great programming, tons of interesting people bringing you food news from all around the country here out of Bushwick. We'll see you next week. Be well. Spring, please come.
There was people in the green.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.